This message was recorded January 10, 2021. The speaker is David Simpson.
Now let's take our Bibles, please, and turn to the book of Hebrews. And of course, we are still in chapter 12. We'll be in chapter 12 for a little while. Now, we are in this opening three verses to Hebrews 12. So why don't we read them together, and then we'll come back and talk about some things here. Wherefore, verse number one, wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of, I want you to put the in there, T-H-E. They didn't put it in. It says our, but it's not our. It's the faith, T-H-E. That's a totally different thing. You can just write it in there because in the original language, it's there. Looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of the faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. The first 10 chapters used by the apostle hung the whole of salvation on Christ and his obedience unto death. By the cross and in connection with the cross, Christ purged sin, established righteousness, and sinlessly performed the work of saving his people. Now we're told in the beginning of Hebrews who he died for. The very end of the first chapter, they are referred to as the heirs of salvation. We're also told when he did this saving work. In verse 3, it says, when he had by himself purged our sins. So when he had himself, by himself, the way it literally is, purged our sins. It declares when and where and how sins were put away. God's people were forgiven. That's where they were redeemed. That's where they were reconciled. That's where they were sanctified. That's where and when they were justified. And then we ask, where is he now? Well, it tells us that after he had purged sins, that he sat down at the right hand of the Father. So he is in heaven right now, and he is mediating in behalf of his saints to the Father. So now what he's doing as he intermediates for us is taking our prayers to the Father and maintaining our just and forgiven standing before God. So that's the first 10 chapters in a nutshell. In the 11th chapter, what the apostle did was to speak of men and women who believe this gospel. He tells us what faith is, and then he declares through a number of people and about 16 people, if I remember correctly, and almost 20 different things that he names, and tells us what they had to go through to continue to believe that gospel. So when we come to the first three verses of chapter number 12, and I won't go through with this all the time, but we find the theme of Hebrews, and it is in verse number 2, looking unto Jesus, and in verse number 3, consider him. That's the theme of Hebrews. Looking unto Jesus, consider him. It's the theme for the first 11 chapters, and it's the theme for the last two chapters. It is the theme of the book of Hebrews. What he is urging them to do is to fully depart from Judaism and go on in the faith, because he's writing to what we believe Paul was speaking to Jews in Rome. And this is a writing of what Paul had written. There are a number of things that are interspersed, such as the warnings that he gives. But Paul, as he spoke to them, and either Paul wrote this or probably someone who heard what Paul wrote and spoke and know what he said, he's urging them to depart their Judaism. If he were here today, what would he say to us? He would urge us to fully depart Arminianism, free will religion, works religion, and he would tell us to go on in the faith, and this faith he's going to speak of. So that's the truth that is here. That's the whole of it. Now, there are some nuts and bolts that make it fit together, and that's what we're talking about would be these nuts and bolts that are here. And the way I've decided to do it is to look at these three verses by looking at a number of two-word parallels or comparisons, two words that couple together that he gives to us. For example, seeing and looking. Seeing what's behind us and looking forward to Christ. That is here. Clouds and witnesses. He's not talking about literal clouds, though the word that he uses is for a multitude of clouds, and it's a metaphor for the host of saints that are an example unto us. They're not busy watching us. Don't be confused. They're not worrying about what we're doing down here. Paul's not worrying about us. Isaiah's not worrying about us. That would be totally boring, totally vexing to them. They're not thinking about us. They're in the wonders and the glories of heaven. That's what they're thinking of. So here it is an example that we have clouds of witnesses, those who've testified to the faith. And then we found another comparison of weight and sin. Weight is anything that keeps us from going on in the faith, whatever that may be. It could be something fun. It could be something terrible. He said, lay aside that weight and the sin, not just a sin, but the sin. And it's the sin that is common to all of us. What is that? It's what he's been talking about, faith. It is the failure to have the faith that we ought to have. It's the failure to go on with our personal faith. That's what he means by this. Now today, we have four more of these. There are seven comparisons. I believe I said eight last week, but there are seven. And so I have four more to try to give to you. First of all, running and fainting. I want you to look, please, in verse number 1, where he said, let us run with patience the race that is set before us. And then at the end of verse number 3, he says, and be lest you be wearied and faint in your mind. So you can put those two thoughts together, run and faint. Now the first thing he says is to lay aside. Of course, that's preliminary to a race. That's preliminary to athletics. You wear clothing to warm up, am I right? But then when it's time to perform, you take off your jersey, you take off your long pants, and then you're ready to go. Runner steps to the starting blocks and he's ready to go. When he said lay aside, this is a point action verb that means that you do this once. Or it could be translated having laid aside. So in other words, it is a definite act on our part of laying aside. And that you have to do. We live in a world of a lot of turmoil. Man, what's going on this week can have us all upset. But what you have to do is set that aside from your mind. You have to set that aside from your heart, and you have to go on. You have to lay aside the many cares of this world, because your care can be yours, your mind can be mine, but we have to let that be set aside. So that's the first thing he says, is laying aside. And then he uses a present tense verb, let us run. Running is what it would be. Now, running is like walking, sort of. It's taking one step, then the next. It's right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot. But running is more consistent, more persistent, and mainly more urgent. Mainly more urgent. I used to jog, but then it got to where my knees hurt and my ankles hurt and my hips hurt. So I stopped running and I walk. I can walk now for the most part. But when I'm out walking, people go by running, and I think how wonderful that would be if I could still run like they do. Some of them just run so easy, they just glide along. There's an urgency about what they're doing that I'm not able to give. No matter how fast I walk, there's not much urgency to what I do. But this running is an urgency. And then he adds, run with patience. Run with patience. That word means to bear up underneath a heavy load. And it's the idea of perseverance. So you persevere in your running. So here's the athlete, steps to the starting blocks, and he runs. He may start out, or she may start out with a sprint, and then they settle into a certain gait, and then they're reserving something for a kick at the end. But the idea here is run with patience. Run with a perseverance. I've always tried to see myself. I get more and more people ask me, when are you going to retire? And they can look at me and tell me that I ought to be retired. You're old enough, you ought to be retired. You ought to be stopped working by now. But I've looked at myself as a long-distance runner. I've tried to picture it in my mind that I'm still going. My race is not over yet. I'm still running my race. How long it'll go, I don't know. I can't say. I have certain things in mind, but I can't tell you. I've not told anybody at work. I haven't told you. Connie and I talk about it. I don't know. I'm trying to run with patience. Run with patience. And I urge you to run your race with patience. The apostle said back in chapter 10, but we are not of them. We are not of them that draw back into perdition. In other words, we're not of them that give up and draw back. Because there are many who start, and they start fast, but then they get slow. And then the next thing you know, they're pulling back. There are many who acquiesce. Our message of free grace sounds wonderful to people, doesn't it? I mean, I think it sounds wonderful to people when they think about free grace. Then they begin to think about it, what that means, how that actually fits together with free grace and how we treat others with free grace, and that God did all of it. Christ is the full condition of it. When they begin to hear it and think about it and begin to put that together, that acquiescence is not enough to carry them. So they're like the seed that immediately sprouted up, and then the sun rises up and they wilt away. They go away. I can tell you this, across my years, I've seen way more people who have acquiesced and given up than those who have fully embraced and kept on. But I know Jesus said this, he that endures, what did he say? He that endures to the end shall be saved. So contrarily, he who does not endure proves that he was never saved and that he remains lost. It's not the starting, it's the keeping on. And that's the way he's talking about it here. So he says running, so running would be the first part of this, and then go down to verse 3, lest you be wearied and faint in your minds. To be weary means due to exertion. Well into the race, the athlete's legs begin to tighten up. The breathing becomes labored. The gait grows irregular. The mind is telling him, slow down. Rest a little bit. You'll pick back up. And then the mind says, slow down. Take it easy. Doesn't matter that much anyway. It's not that important. You've been beat before. You get beat again. Go ahead. Take it easy. Pull back. Lest you be wearied. Lest you be wearied. So here the persecuted believers are growing increasingly weary. Their minds are telling them to give up, give in, join your neighbors, go back to the religion that has acceptance, and everything will be okay. The word faint is made of the word loose. The basic word is loose, and it means to yield, to become loose, to give up to the exhaustion, to give up to your circumstances, to give up on trusting God, to give up in being so strict. After all, many people have many different views, your mind tells you. So why not go back to where others have it so easy? When Jesus fed the multitude, he referred to them as being fainting. And the rest of the apostles are driving home this very point. So for example, Hymenaeus and Alexander, they were in the church, they were in the congregation, but what happened to them? They became weary and they fainted. The last letter that Paul wrote, 2 Timothy, he referred to Demas. Demas, we had discovered before, had been very much a right-hand man to Paul, but what happened to him? He became weary and he fainted. And when John wrote, he referred to those that went out from us. What happened to them? Well, they became weary and they fainted. They were with us. They went out from us, John said. So what they showed is they were never one of us. So it's the end that really matters. Seeing and looking, clouds and witnesses, weight and the sin, running and fainting. Now here's another couple for you. Author and finisher. Look in verse number 2. Looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of, and then as I've already told you, the faith. I do encourage you to write it in there, of the faith. Because that's a different thing between the faith and our faith. You understand that the faith is the one settled body of truth. There's only one gospel. There's only one settled body of truth. Paul said that everything else is perverted. Everything else is another gospel. It has another Jesus. It has another spirit. But for example, it tells us in Acts chapter 6 and verse 7 that the priests were obedient to the faith. Romans 1 begins with referring to the gospel of God. Then in verse 3 of chapter 3, to the faith of God. That's the same thing. The gospel of God and the faith of God is the same thing. In Galatians 2 and 16, it refers to the faith of Jesus Christ. In chapter 3, just a few verses further, it refers to hearing of the faith. So it's not hearing inwardly, it's hearing the faith, that settled body of truth. In 2 Timothy, Paul referred to those who resist the truth and reprobate in the same verse concerning the faith. So to resist the truth, reprobate concerning the faith, that's the same thing, that one settled body of truth. And we can look at many other places where that is so. There is only one settled body of truth. It doesn't matter if you are in South America or North America. It doesn't matter if you're in the first century or the 21st century. It doesn't matter. There is one settled body of truth. And we're always in pursuit of understanding that one settled body of truth. Now look at this. Looking unto Jesus, I talked about the faith, and Jesus is the author of that faith. That word author can be translated leader or originator. If you keep the running metaphor, then it means that he's out in front of the race. He shot out of the blocks. He's out in front of the race. He is the leader. And so those who are followers looking to him. But author is a good translation of this word as well. For example, in 5:9 of Hebrews, being made perfect, he became the author, same word, of eternal salvation. He is the author. He is the author. Paul may have been the writer of certain books, but God is the author. You understand the difference? Isaiah was the writer of Isaiah, but God is the author. Moved along, we're told, by the Spirit of God, carried by the Spirit of God. He's the author, and furthermore, he's the finisher. Now, the word finisher, you know that word, don't you? Jesus said on the cross, it is finished. That little word, teleo, that I've told you many times. Same word here. The finisher, the accomplisher, the completer. For example, in 10:14 of Hebrews, for by one offering hath he perfected forever. That word perfected, completed. He completed their salvation. He completely saved. He completely redeemed. He completely justified. He didn't win an opportunity. He completely saved. Understand the difference? He didn't make it so that you can. He saved. And so you will. He's the author and the finisher. He's the start. He's the middle. He's the conclusion of the faith. It is all about him. What did the apostle say? Being confident of this very thing, that he who hath begun a good work in you will perform, that word perform, complete until the day of Jesus Christ. Seeing and looking, clouds and witnesses, weight and sin, running and fainting, author and finisher. Here's our sixth one, I believe. Considerations and contradictions. Look at verse number 3. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. First of all, the little three-letter word for. It is a word that introduces a comparison. So if you look at verse 2, the end of that verse, and it's set down at the right hand of the throne of God, and then there's a period. And that's the first period for verse 1 and 2. In the original, verse 1 and 2 is one sentence. And then he begins with this little word, for. Now, why does he do that? Well, it is a way of making a comparison. For consider him. It's like saying, we don't have it so bad. For example, look at what Jesus endured. That's what this is saying. So, for is an example. And then the word consider. This is a word that basic word means to think. Logizomai. That's a nice word, isn't it? And that word means to think. And he has a preposition in the beginning of that word that's the word for repetition. So it's to repetitiously think. To think consistently, continuously, and intently, taking into account. That's what he means. So we are to consider. We're to think upon. We're to meditate upon. It's like what Isaiah said in 1:18. Come, let us reason together. Come, let us consider together. And then notice what he said, such contradiction. It's easy to just go over those little words, but of course I like words, so I look at them. And the word such introduces another comparison, another way of introducing a comparison. For such. So you can put that together. For such. And that gives us our comparison. And the word such is then laying stress to what he's about to say. Such contradiction. Such contradiction. That word contradiction, the root word is logos, the word for word, but it also could be logic, which I kind of like. And on the front of that word is a word that means against, so it's against logic. Logic. Jesus was spoken against. So much so that it was undeserved and it defies logic. That's sort of the idea that I get from this. It is against logic that men would speak against him in the way that they did. He did nothing to deserve the way they spoke against him. It's a contradiction. It's a contradiction. And notice it's a contradiction of sinners, not of righteous, but of sinners, men and women who err in the way. Not righteous, but sinners. Helpless, hopeless, poverty-stricken sinners. Rebellious, God-forsaking, God-hating sinners. Contradiction of sinners against himself. The word against is not in, which is in, but in like in place. But this is ice, which implies movement into. A little difference here. I want you to see that. Into himself. So it's against, but it's into, its motion, its movement, its sinners actively against him. The contradiction was actively against him. They didn't just say they were against him. They were actively against him. And then notice it says against himself, against himself, against his person, against his work. The apostles' point is think of what Jesus went through. Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. Think about it. Jesus was born of an unwed mother. He was born in a stable. He was threatened as a child. That threat brought about unimaginable sorrow to those in that area. He was reared in the lowly place of Nazareth. Early in life at some point, but we don't know when, he lost his father. Put him in a place where he had to be the sole support of his family as a carpenter. It tells us that he had no place, no home to lay his head. We know that he was hated by religionists. He was charged with insanity. He was charged with being possessed by demons. He was opposed by his own family. He was rejected, hated, and opposed by even his own audiences that he fed. He was betrayed by one of the 12 that he called to himself. He was forsaken by his friends. He was falsely charged of treason by their Supreme Court in that day. He was executed in the most degrading way possible at that time by the cross that was reserved for the most heinous of crimes. He was the Lord of glory, and yet he said, I am meek and lowly in heart. He was equal with the Father in heaven, yet he made himself of no reputation. He became a servant, made like unto a man. He humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Why consider such contradiction of sinners? Because it keeps us from growing weary, from giving up, from turning back. He is our example. He is our encouragement. Consider him. So when you're down and you're out and you're about to give up and you're blue and you're despondent and you're depressed, consider him. Consider him. Don't look to your politicians. Don't look to your way of life. Consider him. We've seen seeing and looking, clouds and witnesses, running and fainting, author and finisher, considerations and contradictions. Here's the last one. Joy and endurance. Look in verse number 2. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross. Look at that contrast or comparison. For the joy that was set before him. The word joy was a word that they used to describe a place of no care. It was set before him. Joy was set before him. What was set before him? Well, satisfaction that would please the Father, substitution that would stand for his elect, redemption that would redeem his people, righteousness that would justify his people, resurrection, glorification, ascension, whereby he would prove his justification to be true, and he would become the mediator for his people. He looked forward to the joy of having his bride, the church, and then his return in triumph and victory and the new heaven and the new earth. And the joy was so great that he endured the cross, despising the shame. This word endure is the same word for patience that we saw in verse 1, to bear beneath the heavy load. It's a verb that means past, present, and ongoing result. He endured. That's the nature of the cross. He endured before he went to the cross. He endured at the cross. But that endurance has resulted in something that is now wonderful. Wonderful. It is said that he perseveringly he endured, despising. That word means against the mind, to hold in contempt. To Jesus, the cross was a contemptuous thing. It was a shameful thing. It was a disgraceful thing. We read it a little while ago. Did you see the pathos in those verses that Brother Randy read to us? Verse number 20 said, reproach. This is the Son speaking to the Father. Listen to him. Reproach hath broken my heart. I am full of heaviness. And I looked for some to take pity, but there was none. And I looked for comforters, but I have none. Oh, the Lord suffered on the cross. It says in Galatians 3 and 13, cursed is everyone that hangs on the cross. This I consider to be an ugly truth. It's an ugly truth. It's hard to think of the kindly, meek, lowly Jesus having anything in his heart but peace. But it tells us that he suffered shame. It tells us in Isaiah 53 and 10, thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin. Not just his body, but his soul. Justice required his body and his soul for a satisfactory offering. But there's one more thing. Out of all these seven comparisons, one more thing. He has sat down, look at the end of verse number 2, he has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. It is a picture, word, of Jesus being at rest. All the suffering and all the spite is behind him. His righteousness has been earned by his keeping the law. It has been accepted and it has been imputed. He has fulfilled the words of the angels. He shall save his people from their sins. He's not anxious in heaven hoping somebody will believe him. He's not trying to get somebody to be convicted so they'll make a decision and come to him. No, sir. It's not happening. He's at full rest, knowing that his kingdom is working just like he purposed. He He saw them saved. He saw them justified. He saw them redeemed. Now He is sitting at the right hand of the Father. He is mediating for them, for us. He takes our prayers to the Father, and in Him, what do? We rest. We rest. So I tell you, week after week, to rest. Come apart from the world and rest.